And here we go again, time for another edition of Sundays with Shep here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Ryan Priest, and every week at this time we dig through the archives of Hammond's legendary radio raconteur, Gene Shepherd, in search of classic stories from Northwest Indiana and beyond. And these days, when you go to see a Major League Baseball game, you're likely to be treated to some type of dazzling, celebratory, spectacular anytime a member of the home team hits a home run. Well, you have the Chicago White Sox to thank for that, because it was in 1960 when owner Bill Veeck installed the original exploding scoreboard at Old Comiskey Park. However, it had some mixed reaction, and Gene Shepherd tells us how the New York Yankees retaliated during one of their trips to the South Side. Also in the program, Shep takes us down to the banks of the Ohio River for the sights, sounds, and smells of a great fish out. So with that, let's go back to June 18th, 1960, as originally aired on WOR AM in New York. Gene Shepherd goes looking for wet blankets on Sundays with Shep.
And to talk about the little symptom of an illness, to talk about the skin extrusion, to talk about the cold sore, when there's something much deeper that's boiling down there in that old maelstrom that is inside of each one of us, really inside. You remember Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I can remember as a kid. I'm just this little kid, see. I mean, this is when you first begin to note that things are not exactly what they appear to be. And, of course, the child is in a very good position to do this, because the kid does not have a large backlog of biases and preconceptions, superstitions and myths, which constantly beleaguer all the adults that I know who really believe things. They never question them because they, in, quote, their experience, have found these things to be true, quote, again, true. And so the child is completely new. He looks around and he sees these things happening. And I am not one of these poor romantics who say that the child has great insight, the child has great wisdom in him. No, I don't say that at all. I merely say that the child is a clean slate, that he can often see things which are incongruous, which in later years he will not see as an incongruity. Not at all. And so you watch, you see, and when you see and you watch carefully and closely, you will find that oftentimes what passes for knowledge, what passes for lore, what passes for great insight is generally a man with the largest collection of cliches, the largest collection of myths in the crowd, the greatest collection of glop. And so he just rolls it around, writes books about it, too, as a matter of fact. And that makes him even more official. And then he finally has himself illustrated by life, and then he's in. The next thing you know, he's running panel shows and editing magazines. And it just continues to roll on and on like a great sea, a great crashing sea on the rocks of the poor, sad world that we live in. But you can understand... You can see it clearly and completely that things aren't exactly right. And I am not here to complain. I'm only here to say, wow, you know, we're all part of it and we might as well be part of it. Daddy-o, we might as well be. And so I'm this kid one time. See, I'm sitting there and I'm a kid. I'm innocent. I'm just a kid, you know, a clean slate. And I'm taken to the movies. And the movie, the picture, was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Well, you know, I mean, I'm just a kid. And so I'm sitting there waiting for the horses to gallop up, or waiting for Johnny Weissmuller to swing through the vines after Margaret Sullivan. Wasn't it Margaret Sullivan or Maureen O'Hara? No, Margaret Sullivan, I believe. And I'm waiting there for Skippy to show up. Do you remember, do any of you remember when they made a movie of Skippy? I will award the brass figligy with bronze oak leaf palm for anyone who can remember that and can tell me who it is who played Skippy. You know? I remember one time when I was a little itsy, wee, bitsy kid. I guess they don't do that anymore. When the movie came to the local movie house that was so big that they excused school for an afternoon so that all the kids could go see this movie. And it wasn't Skippy. It was a movie starring Tom Ix. And it was about Tom Ix and a little king. I will award the brass figligy with bronze oak leaf palm if you can tell me who played the little king. And it wasn't Otto Saglow's little king either. So I'm sitting there, you know, and this is when I first began to understand this great cesspool that lies deep down within the right underneath the surface. I'm sitting there, and it's the movie of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I believe it was Frederick March that played the role. And I can remember the first scene where he made the great transition. He's in his laboratory. Have you noticed that a real good, honest... it's impossible to find a scientist today that really has guts. I mean, who will go out and hire an insane dwarf to operate his machines for him? Who really... I had a friend the other day who mentioned to me, he's a scientist. He says, you know, I've worked in laboratories now for 10 years, and I haven't seen anybody yet. He said, I wish I would once go to a laboratory and find one guy who's trying to put the brain of a beautiful woman into a fantastic body of an ape. He says, those were real scientists. I mean, they really did things. He says, I have worked in 100 laboratories, and I have not yet once worked in a laboratory where there was a cavern with an insane dwarf who had great big flaming brands that he held up once in a while to light up the titration ceremonies. But nevertheless, I'm sitting there seeing, I'm a kid. This is just in passing. And after all, it's Saturday. What are you doing? You're just sitting on your duff anyway. A lady just called. She says her husband's such a wet blanket, he won't call you, and immediately turns you off when he heard the term wet blanket mentioned. I am now listening to you in my portable radio out in the garage. I'm with you, baby. Oh, it's so sad. You know, the other day I came in, you find out that almost by definition, salesmen are wet blankets. I mean wet blankets. And you know, the guy that hollers the most and that makes the most noise, who places in strategic positions the most whoopee cushions, you will generally find is secretly and down underneath it all the most somber, the most tragic, and the least funny of all men. He's covering up, Daddy. He is covering up. And I'm, speaking of covering up, I'm sorry that you're out there in the garage listening to your portable radio, baby, but after all, you are out in the garage listening to a portable radio anyway all the time. Just by definition, if you are living with a wet blanket. Somehow, though, I must say, I identify with the wet blanket. There's no question about it. So I'm sitting there as a kid, and Frederick March, do you remember the scene? Frederick March takes a drink of this stuff. See, it's like this. He's drinking out of a cardboard cup, a cardboard container. He goes... And then he feels this funny thing going down, deep down inside it, behind his lungs and underneath his liver, and he goes... And then he takes it up again, and it's steaming and hissing. I've always wanted to drink out of a glass of something that steams and hisses and boils and bubbles, and great swirling clouds of smoke roil around my... And this goes on for about 5 minutes. And the next thing I know, there is Mr. Hyde looking out at me. And he puts on his cloak. The Mr. Hyde in each one of us, I might point out, I really it's a superfluous footnote that I'm adding here. The Mr. Hyde in each one of us wears a cloak. Wears a dark cloak and has on a slouch sort of hat, and usually has the collar pulled up around its ears. This is the Mr. Hyde in each one of us. Well, of course, I was terrified. Mr. Hyde skulked around, and it was an awful situation until finally, well, you know what happened in the end of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I was so sad, because Dr. Jekyll was such a nice guy, and Mr. Hyde was such a complete, utter rotter. I mean, a thorough rotter. He reminded me of my algebra teacher. And so I'm on my way home with my mother, and I said, hey, Ma, how come he could turn into this terrible thing? I mean, just by drinking that stuff. And my mother said, I'll never forget it. She says, have you seen Mr. Bruner on Saturday nights? Yeah, Ma, but he's drunk. I mean, yeah. We had a neighbor who used to come home and fist fight with everything. One time he had a fist fight that lasted for over 2 hours with an upright piano in the living room of his home. And he used to fist fight with anything. He would take a swing at a passing stoplight. He would fight fire hydrants on the street. Probably his most, as I said, his most long, the Firpo Dempsey battle of his career was the time when he met the Strawby upright piano. And I might say that it was a piano that perpetually had a nasty mood. And so he picked on the wrong guy that time. And he came reeling in on a Saturday night, and the next thing you know, there they were slugging it out like that, and it was an awful thing. I might point out, for the benefit of those of you who might be tempted to try it, never pick on an upright. At least an upright that's mature. And so, of course, it got to be a natural and a nasty and a rotten situation. Every Saturday night, Bruner would go through this routine. And my mother said to me, "Do you remember Mr. Bruner?" I said, "Yes." She says, "Well, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde." "What do you mean? He isn't a mad scientist, Ma." She says, "No, but he drinks that potion." I said, "But Ma, he doesn't go out and..." She says, "No, that's true. His Mr. Hyde does not go out and murder beautiful young women. But it does murder fern plants in the sun parlor." I said, "Yeah, but Ma, I mean, Mr. Hyde, oh." And then she turned to me and she said, "One day your Mr. Hyde will too come out." And that was the end of that. We rode on home. I was sitting on my side of the streetcar seat and she was sitting on her side. And my kid brother was sitting behind us and my old man was sitting with him. And we rode, you know, and just sat and read the ads all the rest of the way. Because, I mean, what are you going to do when you have truth? I mean, where you go? And of course, the Mr. Hyde in each one of us is there. You know, I'd like to point this out, though, that since there is a Mr. Hyde and there is a Mr. Jekyll, a Dr. Jekyll and a Mr. Hyde in each one of us, the adjustment that we take, the knob that we turn, presents us with an interesting choice. Some people live all of their lives showing only the Mr. Hyde to the world. Only the Mr. Hyde. This is the side of them that wants to immediately leap in a jet plane and go and bomb Moscow. Or go and blow up the Japanese. I mean, that's it. Show them guys who say, I mean, what are these Japanese crying out about? And this is, of course, the Mr. Hyde that's in each one of us. And don't think for a minute, even the most altruistic. I was listening to this clown last night on the Long John Show, and about 4 o'clock in the morning, his Mr. Hyde started to come out. And it was a pretty nasty Mr. Hyde, let me say. And all the while, he had been making a big deal out of the Dr. Jekyll side of him, which was so wonderful, Dr. Jekyll, you know, who loved all of mankind. And so, this little sneaking thing, you got to remember that every altruistic everything, every little incident that occurs in the constantly unfolding tape of man, is an incident that has within it the seed of the Mr. Hyde, everyone. Not one dictator, for example, that I know of in the past 150 years came in, but what he didn't proclaim himself to be the man who owned right. He came in for the good of all people. I mean, we have this in our own hemisphere, right down here in the Caribbean, you know. We come in for all people. Hitler came in claiming that he was going to do good for all people of Germany. In fact, the people believed it. This was true of Mussolini. It's been true of every great movement of this sort. And always, 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 somewhere along the line, somebody says, and there it is. There it is, stalking the streets again. It's just like this beautiful call we got about 10 or 15 minutes ago. This very British voice, a very shrafty-sounding lady, says, "Would you please tell Mr. Shepherd that I'm a damp rug?" She kept using the phrase "damp rug." And, gee, that conjures up beautiful pictures. A damp rug. That, in many ways, is much more colorful than a wet blanket. You know, speaking of damp rugs, as long as we might as well... I mean, we might as well level here. It's Saturday, and this is Class D time. So we might as well sit here and flick the pebbles into the pool. And there are signs, though. Now, let me say this. There are signs that are almost unmistakable. Now, I say almost because man is constantly being... Did you hear what happened last night out at Comiskey Park? Stan Lomax was telling me during the news about what happened, and unfortunately I missed it. But out at Comiskey Park in Chicago, they have this gigantic scoreboard. And it is a new scoreboard this year, and it's caused all kinds of talk. It's a great sensation. And the way the scoreboard works is this, that whenever one of the White Sox ball players hits a home run, the thing lights up like an enormous pinball machine. In fact, they call it the pinball machine all over the league. It lights up like a tremendous pinball machine, and it has great big neon spirals that go, and it has a set of fireworks that shoot off Roman candles out of the top of it, and the whole thing explodes. The White Sox have hit a home run. Pow! Boom! The thing just goes mad. And, of course, when the opposing team hits a home run, nothing happens at all, except one thing, and this is something they haven't talked about. When somebody hits a home run, this machine groans when one of the Kansas City Athletics hits one into the upper deck in right field. The machine goes, Well, last night, I would never have believed the Yankees capable of this. For one thing, I suspect that the Yankees all vote the straight Republican ticket. This is a Republican ball club. This is an organization man's team, if there ever was one. And what happened last night was thoroughly un-Yankee-like. Well, I'll tell you what happened. They were going into the third or fourth inning, and somebody hit a home run. Mickey Mantle drilled a home run, and there was a moment's silence. And, of course, the White Sox scoreboard didn't do anything except register another home run. It groaned a little bit. And then suddenly, out of the dugout came the Yankees carrying sparklers. And everybody is burning a sparkler. Big cheering and hollering. Sparklers are being burnt. And the entire crowd out at Comiskey Park rose as a single man and recognized that they had been outployed. And they just burnt those sparklers away there, and everybody cheered, and that was the end of it. And, of course, the manager of the Chicago White Sox was teed off about it. And Tony Cuccinello had his hat stolen. He says, "This is the biggest Bush League town in the league." And it goes on and on. The whole conglomerate mess builds. And then when you see a thing like this happening... Just occasionally, a little thing will happen. You know that there is some hope. There is some hope for man. How can you get mad at man? Listen to this news note. Did you see this item in the Herald Trib? I mean, you know, you can get teed off. Speaking of being teed off, have you noticed how the great sweep of demonstrations is beginning to take hold everywhere, all over the world? Demonstrations. Every place you go, there is a demonstration of some kind. People are out marching with placards. Well, I think this is a direct result of the technological world that we live in. There's nothing to do. Of course, if you can always say, well, I mean, this little political reason, that little political reason, this economic reason, that economic reason. You can go on and on and on and on and on. No, I think that much lower on the scale of psychological operation, much, much lower, way down deep underneath it all, you are going to see an increasing amount of demonstrating. Demonstrating because somehow it gives a man a sense of taking some sort of action. Most people don't take action in their world, you know, in a technical world. They live in a committee society where all things are decided by the big machine. And when I say the big machine, it's in capital letters, whether it's a big automatic machine or whether it's a big human machine. The point is that hardly anybody ever today feels the satisfaction of actually creating something that makes him indispensable for the moment. In other words, he makes a shoe, or he makes a pot, or he makes something out of the soil with his own hands. He grows a piece of vegetable. Even farms today are becoming great corporate enterprises, and so the farmer is a hired man who operates a hired machine that he doesn't even own. And it's the whole world is getting to the point where it is almost impossible for a man of the great mass of men to get up and say, "I did it." And so you are presented with the situation where a couple of months back, there was a demonstration that broke out in one of the European countries, a great wild demonstration where two or three people were killed. And guys were marching all over the place, and they were advancing on the city hall, and students were throwing eggs at one another. And it turns out, when they finally quelled it all and squirted everybody with water and said, "Now, what is this all about?" Nobody knew what they were demonstrating for, and in fact, they were not demonstrating for anything at all. They were just demonstrating to demonstrate. Now, what is the psychological reason for this? Why do people do this? Don't come around to me and say, "Well, they just wanted to let off steam." What does "let off steam" mean, you see? What does that mean? Where do you get this head of steam? Well, a man used to be able to let off steam, you see, in a lot of different ways, like make things and make decisions even, run his own little world. But today, the world is getting pretty much out of the hands of people. And it's getting to the point where to let off steam, he's got to demonstrate. And he will fill in any kind of a line. He will fall in and start raising placards and start shooting because it gives him a chance to do it. Gives him a chance to say something. Even if and incidentally, the demonstration, the mass demonstration, is a real product of our time, where hardly anybody is capable of demonstrating alone. He has to demonstrate with a group. That even when he's expressing himself or being angry or letting his emotions fly, he has to do it with a large number of other people around him. We are truly mass men today. That the idea of a Jonathan Swift demonstrating by himself or a Voltaire demonstrating against society by himself and getting kicked out is just passé. You're called an idiot or a nut if you do this. And it's a fascinating thing, this whole subject of the demonstration today. Not that I'm against or for what people are demonstrating for or against. I merely say that the demonstrations today have taken on a weight of their own that have nothing to do with what people are demonstrating for. And it's a fascinating thing. I know many guys today who would be perfectly and completely almost gelded if there wasn't something they could be angry about. In fact, I know large numbers of comics, people who write things and who are supposedly humorous people, who can't be humorous at all about people or the world and the situation in which people are just as normal living beings, but have to have individual causes to be angry about. And once that cause is disturbed, I've often wondered what would happen to most of the comics who are touring the nightclub circuit today if the Democrats got elected. If Adlai Stevenson, say, got, then you'd see a sudden rash of sick Republican comics. It would just be the same flip-over. It's all part of the same mystique of the demonstration. And much of the comic world today is based on the feeling that the man in the crowd has today, that he must demonstrate. He will attach himself. His greatest cause today is a non-cause. He will demonstrate for non-causes much quicker than he will demonstrate for causes. And the whole business of demonstration is a very interesting thing to me, and I'm not against action. But demonstrations are not actions. They're merely that, demonstrations. It's fascinating. And the demonstrations sometimes are completely illogical. The other day, I'm down in the village, and everybody's demonstrating about the fact they closed a couple of coffee houses. And one of the guys has got a great big sign about politicians. He's maintaining that it's all a political deal and so on. I stopped him and I says, what is this about? And he says, they closed off. Man, like, get in here. Come here, get in there, man. Like, they're tromping on human freedom, like, man. And they closed the gaslight. Like, they said it's a, what do you know? And I says, well, now, wait, calm down, man. What is this about? He says, well, it's a fire chief, like, it's the squares, man. I mean, with the hippies, hold on. I says, now, calm down, man. What is it about? Now, just what is it? Well, what do you mean, what's it about? I says, what is it about? He says, well, like they say, it's a fire trap, man. Like, it's a trap, man. It's a trap, man. And I says, well, now, just a minute. I've been in these places, and they are fire traps. And he says, I says, now, just a minute. You know, that guys who run taverns uptown, and even guys who run churches uptown, if it's a fire trap, they get closed. It's nothing to do with human freedom. They just don't want a lot of people to burn up. And it just goes on and on. Of course, what I saw in the end was that the demonstration itself was fun, and it was all part of the gradual pressing down of the individual to the point where he can hardly say anything. And so he has to. I have a feeling that there must be a little company out in Jersey somewhere, near perhaps near Tenafly. This seems to be a good neighborhood for that kind. Out there near Tenafly, there must be a little factory that does nothing but turn out protest placards of all kinds, available in job lots, available for immediate use or available in custom use for future protests. You can buy, you can buy protest placards today that are completely ubiquitous, that will fit any kind of protest. And I can tell you this, that if 400 of us, we ought to do this some Saturday. It'd be wonderful. Wouldn't it be great to organize a protest out at Jones Beach? And about 400 of us just quietly march down the beach wearing swimming trunks, carrying signs that say, "How long are we going to stand for this?" And I'll tell you, within 10 minutes, 100,000 people would join us, and another 100,000 would be throwing tear gas at us. How long are we going to stand for this? And everybody suspects somehow he's putting something over on somebody. Either that, or somebody's putting something over on him. So a sign like that would both infuriate and at the same time assuage people. He could all just fill in the blanks. How long are we going to stand for this? I have to say something about this day. I am riding in a cab about, two or three hours ago when I'm coming into the station here, and there was a warm, a genuine summer feel to the air. And a kind of yeastiness to the air. Really was. The all of Times Square was loaded with those people in those flowered print dresses, and all those people riding in the buses with the green windows, looking out, gawking out, and taking pictures with their brownie cameras. And there is that kind of a syrupy quality that you get when you really are in summer, not spring, but summer. And I'm just kind of absorbing it. And I don't know whether you were out in the rain last night, but that was a true summer rain, where the rain came pouring down and I saw a gigantic bolt of lightning hit the top of the Empire State Building and just hang there for about 30 seconds. It seemed to just hang like a great big coat hanger. This huge bolt of lightning just playing around the tower. And the whole Fifth Avenue area was lit up, and it was a beautiful shower. I was wet to the skin, and I loved it. It was just a wonderful moment. And it had been such a long time since I'd really been caught in something like that, really fighting against the wind. And leaves were coming down, and a couple of these walk safely with the green light signs were blown off of the telephone poles next to me and flew past. And it was just one of those wild, alive things, and I was there for a moment. And I immediately thought of something I hadn't thought of in years. We live lives, of course, that go on all the time. Your life does not stop. It does not cut off and operate. Many people think their lives, incidentally, operate sporadically, that between the times they are alive, they spend a lot of time just doing things like working, like toting barges and lifting bales and getting a little drunk and landing in jail and so on. And between the moments of life, there are these great, great areas of emptiness. Whereas, as a matter of fact, the life is being lived all the time, just this great moving pattern that we are all creating as we walk along over the wet sand, does not stop. There are no breaks in it. And each moment is absorbed, rejected, integrated, correlated, and all the other atelated words all poured into one. And as you move along, it seems to me that quite often maturity is called the process of losing perception and the ability to react to the things around you. This was part of the great argument I had with this fellow the other night. He says, "Why?" He says, "You learn after a while that you have a niche and you don't, you shouldn't fight really against the things that seem to be unfightable." Oh no, oh no. This is really not maturity to me. This is a form of death. if you lapse into this tapioca pudding state, which most people call maturity. But I'm standing there in this fantastic rain that came driving down for about 10 minutes last night around 10 or 10:30. And the old lightning's playing around the top of the Empire State Building. And the cabs were skittering sideways. And that rain was rolling along Fifth Avenue on the asphalt like a great bowling ball. Shh. I'll tell you what it reminded me of. Have you ever seen a roll of of barbed wire, of new barbed wire, silver new barbed wire. Well, that's the look that it had, as though a great roll of silver barbed wire was charging up Fifth Avenue in the general direction of the expensive 60s. And it just swept past and through me and all around me, and I was reminded of something which I had not thought of, and I said to myself, I'm going to talk about this tomorrow, Saturday. I have to. Have any of you ever heard of a fish out? This is a Midwestern thing. And I'm sure, well, of course, it's not really, let's put it this way, it is part of river life. Have you ever lived next to a river? Let me tell you what a fish out is. It's a true summer thing. And in a way, it's kind of an affirmation of the soil and being part of the soil. And I find something very intriguing to me. And it is this, that many of the people I know who are purely urban people do not have any genuine feel for the relationship between man and soil. Now, I'm not talking about soil. I'm not talking about the guys who move out to Westport and have a garden. This is not what we're talking about. I'm not talking about the guys who go to Darien and dig their own swimming pool or make their own fish pond. This is not at all the relationship of man and soil, because it's done as a game, you know. These people who grow their little gardens, who become gentleman farmers in Bucks County, are doing it as a game. It is not a necessity. So the relationship of man to soil is, it's like a man who has a hunting preserve, who has a flock of quail put in, and then in the morning he goes out and shoots them. This is not hunting. Something else entirely. I don't know what it is, but it's not hunting. Do you know what the term hunt means? Hunt. Look it up. Hunt. To search for. And you're not searching for anything, buddy, when you let 14 quail go out of a cage and you pop them one after the other like clay pigeons. This is not hunting. And the fish out that I've been part of on two or three occasions is part of the mystique of man versus nature, man part of nature, and that's more important, you see. We like to think of ourselves always in opposition to nature. We constantly hear the phrase, man is finally conquering nature. Ha! What are you talking about, conquering nature? We're part of nature. That's ridiculous. We can't conquer ourselves. How can we conquer nature? It's ridiculous. We are as much a part of nature as the merest turtle and snail. We are as much part of nature as that raindrop that came charging down Fifth Avenue last night. There's no escaping our nature. There's no escaping our clay. There's no escaping our terrible charging red streams that move through us at such a hot, steamy pace. There's no escaping. This is all part of it. You cannot be anything but what you are. And so I remember last night when this rain is charging. What does this remind me of? I mean, it reminds me of the cookout and the fish out. Not the cookout of guys who stand in backyards and do little things with anchovy paste. This is not what I'm talking about. That ever so often, people who have a real remembrance of the relationship of man to soil, man to nature, in other words, have to go back and reaffirm this. There is much of the Druid in every one of us, believe me. There is much of the pagan who worships at the foot of the unimaginable things that grow around us. There's no question about it. It's always there, this lurking little thing. And I remember the last fish out that I was ever involved in. Let me tell you what a fish out is. A fish out is a thing which kind of grows from the banks of a river like a mushroom on a hot July night. And mushrooms you can see grow. Have you ever watched mushrooms grow? Have you ever watched an asparagus? You can watch asparagus growing. Are you aware of that? You can stand right there and see it come right out of the ground, and I am not kidding. This has nothing to do with Walt Disney and stop-action photography. You can stand and watch the asparagus come up out of the ground. And once you've done this, you can never really go back. And once you've done it, well, you see that the asparagus is growing as of a necessity and as of part of the battle, you can never go back, not as part of the game. If you've ever stood in the middle of a celery field outside of Kalamazoo, Michigan, you can't retreat. If you've ever walked through a cantaloupe field in southern Indiana and smelled those ripe melons, and watched them and felt them, and eaten a hot, ripe melon that weighs 4 pounds that you pull right off the ground and put salt on, and it just pours out all over your pants when you open it up, You know something about the soil. But the thing that I remember about the fish out is this. The river has, just the way the sea has to us here on the eastern. Of course, the sea is a remote thing to many of us. It's a remote and yet a constantly attractive thing. But the river is not remote to the people who live in the river valleys. The river is as much a part of their lives as their shoes are, as their socks are, as all the cruddy little things that we live with, as the buttons that come off, and as the bread that we eat. These are the things which are the texture and the real blood of the lives that we live. The moments, the turning on the light switches and the turning them off, the sleeping, the sweating, the drinking water, all of these things are the little things that we do to maintain our lives, and that have their own artifacts that are part of them. And so it is with the river. The river is really a part of the life of the people who live in river valleys. And I spent some time living in the great Ohio Valley, which is a great bowl out there in the Midwest that touches upon Ohio and West Virginia and parts of Kentucky, and it just moves on through Indiana. It's this tremendous valley out there that is drained by this great river, the Ohio. And into the Ohio come all these other rivers, the Little Miami, and there are hundreds of rivers that flow in to this great river that moves slowly and just so everlastingly through the lives of these people. And the fish out is a kind of affirmation of the faith and the knowledge, the secret knowledge, that we are all part of this thing. We are just as much a part of it as the leaves are, even though we like to pretend all the time as we walk up and down Fifth Avenue that we are not. You see, when you live in juxtaposition of a great moving river, and you can feel time moving, believe me, because every minute of the day the river changes. Every hour the river is either moving towards winter or moving towards summer, and you can't escape it. You know, we can forget time almost completely in the city. If you live in one of these great office buildings that's totally air-conditioned, there are no seasons. It is always just the right temperature. The time sort of ticks away endlessly with great quiet clocks set flush to the wall. And it's an abstract completely. It's just a series of numbers. And so you walk out into the city at a certain point, and you step into a cab, and the cab moves along an asphalt street, and you see the fountains playing. It can be winter, summer, fall, spring. It matters not, really. And you move into your own home, which in itself has a kind of soft, cushiony, air-conditioned world about it, too. You turn on the TV set, and certainly this is a never-never land. It's an on-film land, and those shadows move back and forth. And people forget, you know, they forget that they are growing old, really. They forget a lot of things. Maybe they want to. Maybe this is why it's all been created. That's probably true. But you can't ever really escape it. And so the fish out, which is a river function, is a kind of affirmation. It's a druidic rite, a true druidic rite. And I remember one time, the first time I knew and learned of a fish out, I was working. It was late. It was about maybe 10 or 11 o'clock, and I was just about ready to leave the job that I had been working at. I was hot and sweaty. I'd been working all day and all night. And the guy I left the office with says, "I'm going to a fish out." And I said, "What do you mean? Is that why you're wearing those crummy clothes?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm going to a fish out." And he had a kind of rapt expression about him. It was 11 o'clock at night. He says, "Come on along." I said, "Okay." And so we drifted on down to the river about 8 or 10 blocks down, and then we went upstream about 4 miles upstream, driving his little car. And we arrived at the fish out, and it was dark, just as dark as the ace of spades, black. Have you ever seen a river at midnight? Oh, boy. Hardly few things are blacker, perhaps, than the soul of man. And we arrived at where the fish out was being held. And I could see bonfires down there on the shore. And as I approached these bonfires, there was a strange kind of excitement began to grow inside of me, because I knew this was not a barbecue roast. There just wasn't the barbecue roast air about it. And down on the shore, there were 50 or 60 or 100 men of all colors, black, brown, green, all colors of guys. Not hardly any of them knew each other. They had just been drawn together. Somebody had announced there was a fish out. And they came from all parts of the county. And they had drifted down to this one spot on the bank of the river. The old river just flowed, and they were all men. And they were wearing old chino pants and old blue jeans and old jackets and things. And already they were talking in those monosyllables that men talk in when they are really reduced to basics. You know, give me the axe. Rah, rah, chomp, chomp, chomp. Give me the axe. Rah, rah. And they're chopping away. Go down and get some wood. Hey, anybody got any water? Get a bucket of water. Okay. That this is the monosyllabic man, you see, who does not have to have the many syllable words that describe the subtleties. There are no subtleties there. You see, we are down at a druidic and religious rite. And I began to see, playing against that river like the fires of hell, there were about seven or eight big bonfires, and on each bonfire was a huge copper wash basin. You know, the kind that grandmothers used to boil wash in? And they had a cut off broom handle that was all worn and all whitened because of the boiling water, and they used to stand there and move this great big old handle back and forth while they boiled the shirts. Well, they had about five or six of these great big copper tubs that were on little heavy metal grills placed over these huge flying embers and flames, and they were cooking, and they were cooking. Each one of these tubs was filled with grease that somebody had brought down from the hills, and there were great tubs of this boiling, hissing grease, and they were preparing the scene. And back in the bushes that rose up to the sky, of course, this is black, absolutely black. There wasn't a single artificial light there, just the light of these bonfires. No one uses flashlights on these fish outs. They had great big casks of bread. People had brought bread down. And out in the darkness, I could hear voices. And the guy said to me, "Let's go down and look at the lines." I said, "What lines?" He says, "Come on, man, let's go." And we walked down on that muddy bank, and you could smell the river. You can smell the river at this time of the year. Do you know what the river smells like in early summer? It has something about it. It just makes your mind practically go blank. It is so green and so froggy. It is so alive and so rich and ripe. And you can smell that mud, and you can smell that water, and you can smell those bullheads moving along on the bottom. He says, let's go and look at the lines. And so we walked down, maybe 400 or 500 or 600 feet downstream. And downstream you could see all these dark figures moving back and forth, absolutely black, stygian black. And they were laying the trap lines. Well, the trap line, in case you're not familiar with it, is a piece of twine, thick twine, white twine, cotton twine, that maybe is, 100 yards long, perhaps, something like that. 100 yards, I would say. And it has strung along it hundreds and hundreds of little lines that extend down, and at the end of each one is a weighted fish hook. And each one of these fish hooks is baited with a dough ball. And at the end of this trot line is a weight, and on another line that extends from that weight is a great big gallon jug that is empty, that has a cork in it that's sealed and is used as an enormous bobber. And the way these trot lines are set is a sight to see. To see a man who really knows how to throw a trot, you are seeing a man who really has completely integrated himself with the horizon that he knows. The trot is laid this way. The guy swings it over his head. And at his feet, these great coils of twine, all very carefully laid out with the fish hooks, all very carefully celebrated. Celebrated in each his own right. Celebrated and laying there quietly, shining in that moonlight. And lying there all very, very carefully laid out so that they don't tangle one with the other. And then he goes... And as he does this, he plays the line out gradually until suddenly he lets it go at the backswing. And that great big old jug curves beautifully and out, 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 out over the river until finally way out you hear that. And the line sinks and his trot has been set. And they lay maybe four or five lines like this along the river bank. All these men, and hardly anybody knows each other, because you see, the point being, again, it's one man and another man. It has nothing to do with who you know. We are all men. And they all speak in these monosyllabic, grunts. Give me the axe. And so you have five trot lines laid, and everybody drifts back to the fires, and you can smell the grease. The grease is really boiling and bubbling. And someone begins to tap the kegs of beer. They have four kegs of beer, three of which are always in the river to keep cool. And the other has been dragged up on the rocks and has been bunged. Have you ever heard anybody bung a keg of beer at 2 o'clock in the morning on the riverbank in a hot, steamy summer night? Oh, it's fantastic. It goes, boom, give me the, you hear him trying to stick the bung in there, and then he draws one, says fine, and then it begins to work, and everybody's drinking out of tin cans, lukewarm beer, and they're waiting. And then finally, one of the guys gets up and he says, about time, let's go, Charlie, let's go. And about nine guys, along with Charlie, dark figures against this dancing flame, go downstream and they begin to pull in one of the trots. Hand over hand, they pull it in. And it's heavy. Oh, boy, it's heavy now. Hand over hand, they're pulling in this great, great weighted line. And one by one, each hook comes out, and on each hook is a big flopping catfish. And as he pulls it in, one guy grabs the catfish and he pulls the hook out and throws it into a tub until finally they have completely defished this enormous trot line, and they have a whole tub full of flopping catfish, some of them weighing as much as 20 pounds, others as little as a pound or so. And two or three of them grab the tub and they struggle in. Let's go! And as they move upstream, The other guys are getting ready with the little wooden tables that they brought down to clean the fish. And you should see seven or eight guys cleaning fish by the light of the dancing fires on a riverbank. It is like some scene right out of Dante. You can hear the fish flopping and the guys are saying nothing and they're working away. And you can smell the blood and you can hear the knives going. And as they clean each one, one guy takes it and washes it off in another big tub, and he throws it into this great big boiling, hissing, steaming cauldron of flaming grease. Until maybe 15, 20 minutes later, you have a great big wash tub full of deep-fried fish. And the way they're fried, by the way, they don't fry them whole. They fry them, they deep-fry them till the fish fall away from their skeletons. And great, great mounds of fish flesh, all beautifully crisped and fried, lie at the bottom. And they drain it out, and they scoop it out, and they put it on pieces of bread, and they just sit around there and eat. They sit around and eat and drink beer. Well, this goes on all night. All night. Because it always begins on a Friday night, the fish out. All night. And the guys are drinking beer, and they sleep. They don't go home. They sleep and they lie on the riverbank all Saturday, drink more beer and eat more fish. They start all over again Saturday night. Their whiskers are growing and they're speaking more and more in short grunts. And as they approach Sunday morning, which is very, very 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, they are complete savages. And it's a fantastic experience. You're down there eating the fish. Give me more fish. And your whiskers are growing and your clothes smell like bullhead and smell like dough balls and smell like river and smell like mud and smell like people. And you just... And you go on and on and on and on. And by this time, there are about 200 guys involved. Other guys have caught in wind, you know, of the big fish out that's going on down on the old Ohio. And there's about 100 of them lying out in the bushes eating fish and grunting. And they're all colors, all shapes, all sizes. It means nothing. They're all battling the same thing, the river. And then as it dawns Sunday morning, what a sight. 3 days guys have been down there, their whiskers. Their eyes are blurry from beer. They've been eating fish, and there's a kind of a genuine Neanderthalic quality about them. And then one by one they gradually drift back to civilization. Grunting, off into the jungle. Ah goes. He goes back into the jungle. And it's impossible to explain to women. Let me tell you that. Impossible. You arrive back in the city, you're driving through the streets, and it looks like some peculiar wild fantasy land that has no relationship to reality. These streets, I'm telling you what happens. You get back, and you go to the house. I remember I was living, and I had this landlady. I had this little room, and I arrived at the front door. She slammed the door on me. I said, "It's me! Me!" And she opened the door, and she says, "Why, it's you, Gene. What's happened to you?" I go, "Out of my way, woman." I threw her down to the rug. And I went stomping upstairs, leaving a trail of mud behind me and worms, catfish, all sorts of terrible, awful, slimy things that grew in the river. And I lay in the tub, and I squirted hot water on me, and I shaved, and gradually it came back, and I got just as phony as ever. Within a half hour, I was reading Variety and the whole business. Oh, what a world. Oh, it's coming back. Oh, boy, I'm beginning to smell fishy now. Yeah.
And from June 18, 1960, as originally aired on WOR AM in New York, Gene Shepherd describes the sights and sounds and smells of a great Ohio River fish out on Sundays with Shep. And that will do it for this week's edition of Sundays with Shep. As always, we appreciate your feedback. You can drop us an email with your questions, comments, maybe your memories of Shep. The email address is sundayswithshep@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com and search for Sundays with Shep. Give us a like, and then you'll get access to show previews, Shep-related trivia, and the chance to interact with other fatheads around the world. And if you'd like to hear this or previous editions of Sundays with Shep one more time, you can find podcasts on our show page. That's at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Just click on the Programs tab at the top of the page and scroll down to Sundays with Shep to catch up on some of the shows you might have missed. Coming up next week, stories from the world of racing. Until that time, I'm Ryan Priest. For everyone here at Lakeshore Public Radio, thanks for spending part of your Sunday with us. Have a great week, and we hope to have you back here next Sunday with Shep.